All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck nicks, what the fucksters, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast from inside the house, inside the garage. Man, people are going nuts, and I get it. I get it. I was going nuts, but I go out and I run and shit, and I try to stay sane. Trying. There have been a couple of nights where I wake up and I'm freaking out. How are you guys doing, man? Look, I'm fortunate, and I know that in the sense that, like, I'm okay for now. But I know that's not everybody's story, and I want to be empathetic with that and say, you know, I feel for you. I've been where you are, but not in this position, in this situation where we're helpless, powerless to change anything. It's tough. And, you know, I'm sorry that we're all going through it. And I want to make sure that I keep my empathy, because I'm not naturally fully empathetic. Like, I feel things, but they're usually in relation to me. Like, in order for me to kind of engage that muscle and really kind of get things into perspective, I've got to meditate on it a minute. And I realize, and I want to make sure that I understand out loud that, I am grateful for a lot of the people that are going to work amidst this fucking nightmare. First responders, healthcare professionals, people delivering food. I know a lot of lip service is paid to this, but I don't think there's ever going to be enough ever going through it or in retrospect. There are people that are really stepping up and that are really being selfless in this. Maybe some people out of necessity, but some people truly have the heart to be selfless. And, you know, it is a holiday period for some. And it just, I just want to make sure I put that out there to remind myself and everybody else that, we get selfish and, we think like, well, this is fucking inconvenient. And here I am living a life of leisure to a degree, though with the sort of constant current of terror anytime I go out in order to do an essential bit of business, grab some food, take a run, wearing the mask. A lot of people making masks. I've not had any problem adjusting to the masks and seeing people with masks. You gotta get the right mask so you don't pass out. If it's too thick, you might black out, and then you're gonna think you have something wrong with you, and then you're gonna end up in the hospital and expose yourself to other possibilities, take up valuable time for someone to tell you that you hyperventilated because you were breathing your own air and breath into a mask and right back in again. There's nothing wrong with you. Get a different fabric. You're okay. By the way, my guest today, Taylor Tomlinson, I'm sure most of you have watched her special by this point, Quarter Life Crisis. It's now streaming on Netflix. She also does a bit on YouTube, I believe, with her boyfriend, who is also a comic, Sam Morrell, who's going to be on Thursday's show. Both of these interviews this week are post-quarantine interviews, people that came over amidst the home shelter and distancing rules to be part of this essential service, the podcast. We took proper precautions, we took pictures at a distance, and we did it. We overcame it, but this is in real time, real face-to-face shit. 6 feet apart, folks. 6 feet apart. So a couple months ago, folks, we put out a special edition line of merch to celebrate the first 10 years of WTF, and the response was so great, we made a second line of posters, t-shirts, and new enamel pins. These are all new designs by the same artist, Johnny Jones, and you can get another limited edition poster signed by me, a new glow-in-the-dark t-shirt, and a tentacle head enameled pin. These are some great trippy designs by Johnny, and just like the first batch, we're only making one run of this stuff. We'll post some pictures on Twitter and Instagram, and you can go get this stuff at podswag.com/WTF or go to WTFpod.com and click on the merch link. Dig it. I want to tell you that Sword of Trust, the film that Lynn Shelton made that I am in, along with Michaela Watkins, Jillian Bell, John Bass, Toby Huss, Dan Baxdahl, is now on Showtime, both on scheduled viewings, and you can stream it on Showtime. It's now, if you have Showtime, you can watch Sword of Trust. Enjoy it. So I was talking to you the other day, that monkey was experiencing difficulty breathing, my near 16-year-old cat, and had to go to the vet, and I explained to you the process. I hadn't done the process, but I did the process, man. Right after I talked to you on Thursday, I got him in the cage, acted quick, had it open, top loader, dropped him in there. He freaked out, but he didn't shit or piss, which is progress. Drove to the vet, got there about 10 minutes before they came back from lunch, parked behind the place. At 2 o'clock, I called in to the front desk, said, I got Monkey out here. And they said, well, send somebody out. They sent somebody out, took Monkey in. I waited, got a call from the front. How do you want to pay for this? Paid for it on the phone. They brought Monkey back out, brought him home. I think he's doing all right. Doctor checked up on me. It's fucking heroes, man. I mean, some people, all they got's their fucking pets. And these people are working. They're working. People are working to save human lives, but they're also keeping pets alive, which are helping keep people sane and emotionally connected. Don't want to fall into yourself or get sick. Also, saw a movie I'd never seen before. Not a Criterion Trip. It's weird, man. I just had this craving to see some early James Caan. Old footage of The Tough Jew. Then we found this movie called Slither. Worst title. Kind of a great movie, though. Kind of a great little comedy from the 70s, early 70s. James Caan, Peter Boyle, Sally Kellerman, Alan Garfield is in it. Rest in peace, Alan. Lost Alan Garfield last week, a few days ago. Alex Rocco is in it. It's kind of a great little movie. Sally Kellerman played my mother on Marin, and I love her, and I hope she's okay. Alex Rocco, who played Mo Green in The Godfather, did one of his last bits of acting on my show, Marin. With Elliot Gould. It was Elliot Gould and Alex Rocco on that episode. Tremendous. Oh, man. I've had some good moments in my life. But this movie's kind of crazy. It's kind of a crazy movie. And I recommend it because it's got that 70s vibe. But it was before comedies became overwritten. And there's some genuinely kind of funny shit in there. And James Caan is just playing like an ex-con, oddly. But kind of a sensitive guy, kind of a, you know, slightly scared guy. And it's kind of genius. There's bits between Kellerman and Caan that are just great, and Peter Boyle's great. Maybe it's just me, but I never heard of the movie. So I had to rent it on iTunes. It's called Slither. See, I guess the problem was really that there was some, it sounds like a horror movie, and there was a horror movie called Slither, but this is Slither. It was in, it's 1973. It's just a great little 70s movie that I knew nothing about. Okay? That's all. All right? Also, maybe The Gambler would be good. The original Gambler? Wasn't that Mazursky? Am I making that up? Somebody help me. Hey, Google. Who directed The Gambler with James Caan?
The Gambler was directed by Carol Rice.
Oh, really? Why was I thinking Mazursky? That's weird. Hey, Google, who wrote The Gambler with James Caan?
The Gambler's story was written by James Toback and Fyodor Dostoevsky.
Toback. That's it. James Toback and Mazursky. I got them confused. All right. So Taylor Tomlinson, I didn't know going in. You know, she got pitched. She's a comic. She's a fan of this show. And I didn't know her. I've never seen her before. I didn't know her from around. I don't know where she came from. And I prejudged her special. You know, I'm like, who's this young comic that all of a sudden can just do an hour? And it was tight and well-written and well-performed. I mean, it's good. She's a good comic. And she's young. She's in her 20s. I was like, how do you get that much shit together? I'm trying to think, when did I get my, wow, 63, 73, 83, 93. I was 32 before when I did my half hour and I barely had it together. She's like 27 or something when she did this. Anyways, the special is called Quarter Life Crisis. I enjoyed it. She's great. And she's got a great story. I was happy to talk to her. I'm happy that she came over. She was the first Let's Sit 6 Feet Apart guest. There hasn't been many since her. There's only been three in total. But this is me talking to Taylor Tomlinson. Do we have to do 6 feet?
Because you can pull that. 6 feet? I mean,
you're all right over there. You okay?
Yeah, this feels all right.
You feel far enough away? I have everything you need. There's hand sanitizer.
Look at this.
There's some rubber gloves.
Amazing.
I don't anticipate that we'll need the rubber gloves.
I mean, I was just like, I don't know how nervous he is.
It really comes down to, I don't know. I've been out.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to supermarkets. I'm not worried about you giving it to me, but I don't know me.
Right.
You?
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt too. I mean, when my team was asking me about doing podcasts, I was like, give me like one more week that I haven't been on a plane.
Right.
Because if I give Marc Maron coronavirus,
yeah,
my career is over.
No, it's not.
Right? Just as it's beginning.
Come
it's
on.
Over.
No,
like, she killed the king.
No one's going to blame anybody. I'm the king of what?
I mean, of comedy, I think.
Oh, come
I mean,
on.
I feel like, all right, I have to say this up top, and I'm sorry if it makes you uncomfortable.
This sounds exciting.
This is like my oldest comedy dream.
Yeah.
Of like, you started this podcast 6 months before I started doing comedy, which was my junior year of high school.
So like a little over a decade ago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2009, right?
Yeah, right.
And so listening to this podcast is like how I learned how people became comedians.
Really?
Yeah. Well, and I started in a weird way. I started in like churches and stuff.
Okay, wait, let's go back. So, okay, so you're listening to my show secretly. Did you actually listen to it secretly when you were in high school?
Oh, yeah, no. This was not something I was throwing out in the car with my dad.
Right, nobody, and I'm sure your friends are like, Mark who? What?
You are the only comedian I've ever paid to go see.
Come on.
You are.
When was that?
When I turned 18, you were at the Ice House in Pasadena,
and
I've never been to a comedy club because I don't know how to make a fake ID.
Right.
I was a good kid.
Yeah.
And it was you headlining with Eddie Pepitone and Maria Bamford.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It was insane. And I remember I sat in the back of the Ice House. I still feel this way when I perform there. And just felt like, oh my God, it's supposed to be like this. Like, this is how it's supposed to sound
on
all the albums and specials I listen to. This is it. It was like a huge turning point for me. And as was listening to your podcast. So, this is like very surreal for me.
Oh, well, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
I didn't know who you were.
I know. We've never met.
How was I going to know who you were? That's the weird thing about, like, you know, these specials come out and yours came out. When did it come out? A few weeks ago?
A week before yours, I think.
Oh, so we're all in the same kind of cluster?
Yeah, a week before yours.
Oh, okay. So you're still really doing press around that.
I mean, I was.
Right.
Now everyone's kind of like
nervous about it.
Can we do anything? Yeah, still doing like interviews over the phone.
Right. And the thing that's weird about Netflix is you don't know. You have no idea how many people are watching. All you can do is watch Twitter or watch whatever you're doing, like whatever platforms you're on. It's like, are people watching it? Those four people seem to.
Right.
I got 9 tweets today. That means what? Times a million. That must be how many people. But you come out and I'm like, where the fuck? But I don't know all the young people who are doing the young up and comers.
Mm-hmm.
And you're dating Sam?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know that guy because I think he middled for me what's that one? Sunnyvale.
Mm-hmm. Oh, at Rooster Tees?
At Rooster Tees. I think Sam middled for me at Rooster Tees once when it must have been almost, you know, probably 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, but I know that I didn't know he was out here.
Yeah, he's out here now for the foreseeable future. He was out here visiting and he had already been out here a lot in February.
Oh, okay, right. So he wasn't living here. You're just stuck with him now.
Right,
yeah.
Very happily stuck with him. But he lives in New York. He's never going to move. I live here. I'm from California. So
he lucked out to get out of there.
I know.
How long has he been out here?
I mean, he's been out here since the 8th.
Man, because it's a fucking disaster there.
I know.
I imagine it's going to get that way here to some degree, but like we're naturally sort of isolated as people here. Like our communal experience is not like New York where you walk outside and you're in it.
Yeah, and you just rely on public transportation.
Everything.
Like, we all have cars.
Yeah, and there's people everywhere, all around you all the time.
Yeah.
He got out.
Yeah. I mean, he was considering going back on like the 12th, like, because things were about to get bad, and he's like... He is a New Yorker. Like, he felt very loyal. He felt like he should go. And I was kind of like, I mean, I totally get it if you feel like you need to, but I feel like it would be safer for you to just not even get on a plane.
Yeah. No, good call. How long have you been with that guy?
Like 6 months.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So obviously there's no reason that I would have known you before. I mean, we don't seem to travel in the same circles, but it is kind of daunting and impressive that, you know, how old are you?
26,
and you got that like hour plus of solid shit.
Thank you. That looks
pretty honed, pretty tight, pretty revealing. You got a good pace to you, but you're talking about some pretty daunting personal shit.
Oh, thank you.
You're like Mulaney, like it sneaks in. You're like, this guy, look at this kid, Chipper, has got good style. Wow, that was kind of dark. What just happened?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely tricking people. There was darker stuff that I didn't put in this special because I was like, if this special goes well, maybe then people will come see me on purpose and then I can be a little more honest. So like the new hour that I was doing on the road right before, you know, you can't do shows anymore, was like much darker and much more personal. And even I did Hilarities in Cleveland 2 days after the special came out.
Yeah, it's nice. And that guy, Nick.
Yeah, Nick and Sam and them. And Sam goes, the manager there goes, yeah, so did you get any like pushback from your reps about how much like darker you are now? And I was like, I don't know, but they haven't seen it yet, I guess.
More, is it personal?
It's personal, yeah. It's a lot. Like I had jokes about like losing my mom as a kid that I just didn't put in this one. Because I'm like, let's just make this one about...
My dad is still alive. Let's just take the shit out, you know, just like throw dad under the bus for a while.
Just a little bit. I mean, I feel like I cushioned it.
No, definitely.
But yeah, no, there's more to be said about my relationship with my dad, for sure. Yeah,
and about your childhood in general.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a delicate balance, you know, because I had to deal with that with my special, but it wasn't so much personal darkness. It was a general sense of foreboding doom, you know, which I think resonates with people. But if you're not careful, not unlike personal darkness, people will get to a point where they're like, all right, we're good.
Yes.
You know, so you sort of got to balance it with these other bits, you know, the kind of, you know, to structure it so people don't go off the cliff and they're not going to look at you and go like, this, she's got problems.
Right.
This is sad now.
Right. You got to say, we're all going to die. Also, supplements seem like bullshit. Yeah. You know?
Right. But I've done that sort of personal thing to like to an extreme as well through different parts of my life. I don't know what I was doing at the Ice House, but some of that stuff gets kind of weighty. And then you have these people that are like, well, I mean, is this therapy? I hate that fucking question. It's like, no, it's organized, structured, funny things about sad parts of my life.
Yeah.
Designed to make you laugh.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
Don't you hate when people ask you if it's therapy?
Oh my gosh. I have a lot of jokes about therapy now, which maybe heads that off a little bit or maybe leans into it. I can't tell. But yeah, no, I hear people say that not to me directly, but about other people. Where like, I don't know. It just was that therapy or something.
Right.
And these are just, you know, civilians, not other comedians. And I don't know. I personally love it when comics get really dark and personal. So I feel like I don't totally understand it, but I could sort of sympathize with an audience on the road that is just trying to have a night out and got a babysitter.
Yeah, there's people I don't owe them an apology, but I'm not everyone's idea of a night out.
Yeah, but it's like, you got Google, like, look me up.
Yeah, do a little research.
Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah, kind of.
But like, you've experienced that, like the nature of mining yourself for material, especially if it's dark. And also, like, there was part of me watching your special where I'm like, how big of a problem could it be? She's 12. This big life crisis she's having. How much am I going to empathize for the girl who's complaining about her quarter life crisis? But it really, I think it seems like about a third of it is really dealing with being your age, and the other bit is about how you grew up.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And just not feeling ready to make any decisions that would move my life forward.
Except that you have this like incredibly tight hour plus of stand-up that clearly you've been working on diligently and in a very focused way.
Yeah, definitely. But that's just because I think I'm going to die really young. So I think, oh, yeah. I mean, when your parent dies really young, you go, oh, I guess I'm going to die at 34 also.
Oh, my God. 34?
34. So every time I get something in this business, I'm like, well, I mean, I'm about to die, so it makes sense that the universe would, or God or whoever would give me this before I die. I mean, when everything went down, like a week after my special came out,
you're like, oh, here we go.
I was like, yeah, this is what
this
I,
adds up.
Yeah.
But it's funny, mine came out a week after and I felt the same way.
Right?
But I was like, I timed this just right. I mean, I was talking about this, you know, this makes perfect sense. But I didn't think it made perfect sense because, of course, I'm going to die. It was like, I did it.
Yeah.
I got in under the wire. I was, you know, this is great timing for me, bad timing for the world.
Yes, exactly. Do you feel like people are more likely to find your special and watch it because of the name?
Or yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I thought, too. But then I was also like, does that mean, do you think people are also like, I don't want to think about the fact that it's the end times, so they'll avoid it. Because I'm the type of person who like wants to watch Contagion right now.
Right. No, it's very, a lot of people are.
A lot of people are. Yeah. But then the other side of it is people going, I would never,
I guess,
right now.
I think that's wearing out, though. I think that like in times like these where people are painfully aware of what's happening, you know, the desire to distract yourself is heavy, but you're also very onto it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, when you're just going through life and your problems are everyday problems and you like check out however you're going to check out, which is like most of your fucking day,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, you're not thinking like I'm dying.
Right.
So like, I think the idea of checking out now, it's a little more loaded because how are you going to do it? Like, I'm just going to get my mind off this and you're not doing anything else.
Yeah.
But sitting at home wondering how this is going to fucking pan out.
Yeah.
So you might as well look at the worst of it. Let's watch Contagion to see what we're up against.
Yeah, I Googled it. The end, they find a vaccine. So
same with Outbreak.
Yeah.
Yeah, they find the monkey at the end of Outbreak.
Right. If the end was there's no more Earth, then I wouldn't watch that.
What just came on?
What was that outside? That.
Yeah. I'm having like, wow. So, all right. But now I feel like I've dealt with this. You're a special guest. You know, this happens. And this is the new space, and this is not as noisy as it could be, but it won't last forever.
Yes. Much like this pandemic, we hope.
I hope. What are you doing?
What am I doing?
Yeah, for this pandemic situation.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I'm lucky that Sam stayed here because, I mean, I was not going to go see my family or anything coming off of 2 weeks on the road where I was like Vegas to New York to Cleveland.
Right.
I was like, all right, I guess I have to not see anybody for 2 weeks. But he was also coming off of being on the road from here to there to wherever.
Yeah.
And we had already been together for a few days. So it was like, okay, if you have it or I have it, we've given it to each other.
Right.
So let's hunker down here.
Right.
I mean, or you can go back to New York and also self-isolate, in which case we just would have been on FaceTime all day.
Right.
But for us, it's pretty nice because we're long distance.
Right.
So we've never gotten to like...
Hang out
like
that,
this.
How's that going?
It's actually going great.
Really?
Yeah, we're like, I mean, we're just like very good friends. Like,
right.
I would just hang out with him anyway. I was hesitant to date him because I was like, I would like to be friends with you. And he's like, well, I'm not going to be your friend now. And I'm like, okay, well, then I guess we'll date. But I was like, I like you so much as a person. And I feel like we, you know, could hang out forever.
He's a sharp guy. He's great, great joke writer.
Yeah.
Seems like a sweet, sort of soft-spoken dude. I don't really know him, but he doesn't seem like a loudmouth or a guy who's going to make a scene.
No, not at all. Very nice guy.
Yeah.
So we've been making dumb videos and started a movie podcast for the time being. And what most people, I think, are doing.
6 months you've been with him.
6 months, yeah.
First comic you've dated?
No. Second comic I've dated?
Who's the other guy? I don't know why I'm asking this.
I don't know. I don't think you know him.
I was married to a woman who was a comic trying to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it got ugly around that. I think that the deepest resentment she had towards me was something I did not do for her as somebody in show business, which is bad.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you guys had any? Well, no, I'm not going to put any bait in your head. He's had a special.
Yeah, he just had a special come out called I Got This with Comedy Central.
Right. So you guys are good? You're even?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's interesting because, like, the other comic I dated was not, like, better than me.
Right.
We were like, the same age and stuff. So it's been interesting for me dating somebody who's, you know, been doing it closer to, like, 15 years and is, in my opinion, just clearly better, and I would never...
Different.
Like, I mean, different, yes, but also just been doing it longer. So, you know, it's hard to argue with that. So... And he's never made me feel like that or said anything, but I feel that way. And so...
I don't know if it's necessarily true. I mean, he does a different form. He's like a joke guy. I mean, you're a joke woman, but, you know, you're long form person.
Right. Yeah, we have very different styles.
Yeah, he's like joke to joke. Like, he's like a tell style, right? Or used to be. Yeah. And then, but you're like long form, like personal stuff.
Right. Yeah. Which I wish I were more topical. Right?
Well, I always wish I could write tight jokes and be satisfied with it. I mean, I think when you do long form, you know there are jokes in it, and you know you're getting laughs, but there's some magic to writing one-liners or just three-line jokes that land. I just, even when I've done it, it's like doing math to me. Like, you know, you're just sitting there writing these jokes, and then, like, and it's not satisfying enough for me to just be like, that one landed.
Yeah, no, like, I need you to laugh and also see me.
Yeah.
You know, this is also for me.
This is what I've been doing to know who I am. And now I have my space as a human, and I need you to hear me and see me.
Yeah.
No matter what, you don't have to like me, but I have things to say.
But I exist.
Yes, it's exactly that's why I did it. Were your parents like painfully selfish on top of Christian? Or your dad anyways?
I don't know. I mean...
I think I am the way I am because they took up a lot of air.
Yeah, I mean, I had an interesting situation after my mom passed away. My dad got remarried somewhat quickly and sort of got to, like, revamp his life a little bit. Like, he got
reboot.
A new... Yeah, he got, like, a new career and we moved to, like, a nicer place and, like... He got a new wife who he's still with, and she's wonderful, and they're an amazing couple. But it was a strange dynamic that I'm probably still working through in therapy to be mourning like the loss of the most important person in your life while the other most important person in your life is falling in love and in the midst of like a honeymoon period, essentially, which he deserved. I mean, at that point, he'd been through the ringer for years with my mom being sick. So I'm glad he was happy. But
where did you grow up?
I grew up in like Modesto until I was like 10. And then I was in Temecula.
Now, those are L.A. satellites, right? Or are they Bay Area satellites? I always forget.
Yeah, Modesto is like an hour from Sacramento.
Okay.
And then Temecula
is
like in between L.A. and San Diego. It's like closer to San Diego.
Okay,
Inland
so one's
Empire.
Up north and one's a little south.
Yeah.
Okay. So how old were you? Are you the only kid?
No, I have three younger sisters.
Three younger sisters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So your dad was doing what up there in Modesto?
He was a music teacher.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, he's like an amazing singer. He's so good. I mean, he wanted to be a performer and then realized like he couldn't travel that much and also like have a family, and he really wanted a family. So he changed his major to music education because he was like, no, I want to have kids and I want to be there and stuff. And so I think when I started doing stand-up, he and I took a class together, which was his idea. That's how I started doing stand-up. And... I think he got a real kick out of it and probably still does to a degree that I am making a living being a performer.
But like how, so he taught what ages like?
He was teaching high school. I think he taught like all grades at a certain point. But my memory of it is that he was teaching like show choir high school.
So does he play an instrument?
Yeah, he plays piano.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And so your siblings must be, one of them must be pretty young still.
My youngest sister is 20.
Oh, okay. So how old were you when your mom passed away?
8. So we were 2, 4, 6, and 8.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
That's fucking horrendous.
Yeah, it's early.
I mean, what happened?
She had cancer. I mean, you know.
Really?
Pretty standard. She had Hodgkin's lymphoma that I think became breast cancer, was coupled with breast cancer, but it was Hodgkin's lymphoma.
And it happened after she had all of you, or did she know that she was sick?
Right after she had my youngest sister. And I guess she was having like really terrible night sweats and went to the doctor a couple times and they were like, it's hormones. And then turns out it was cancer. Yeah.
But so they must have started pretty young, huh? How old was she when she had you? Like 24 or something? Or 26?
I guess maybe. She was 25?
Wow.
26? I guess, 26 maybe.
Your age.
Oh, I was turning 9 like 2 months later, so she must have been 25 when she had me.
And so your memories of her are vague, or?
I probably have the most memories of her, and I only have a handful. So, like, my youngest sister obviously doesn't remember anything. I think my second to youngest sister remembers a tiny bit. And then, you know, me, like, the two older ones, me and my other sister, we have a handful. Uh-huh. But, you know, yeah.
Like what? Like food, I mean, going to the...
Yeah, like shopping for school clothes at Walmart.
Really? You remember that?
I remember that. I remember times she got mad at me. Like, that's the thing is, all the things you remember from your childhood were either, like, really, really great or really, really traumatic. So you're like, oh, remember that time that we, you know, ate cookie dough in the middle of the night and scrapbooked? And it's like, remember that time she locked you in the garage? Like, it's, you
what?
Know, you're like,
yeah.
there's a real... difference between all the memories, and they're all very heightened, which is interesting.
Do you like? I'm only asking this because I talked to Sean Lennon about it. Do you sort of? And he brought it up that the memories he does have of his father that are his own, he really like almost like nurtures them, he holds on to them and makes sure that they don't fade.
Yes. I think so too.
You do? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I will catch myself sometimes going, ooh, I don't remember what her voice sounds like. I need to watch an old video or something.
Wow.
You know, because you just start to forget.
There are videos, though.
There are some videos, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
I mean, not like, you know, if I had kids, what they would have now. I mean,
right.
It's the best time to have a dead mom right now. You can go through their Instagram.
I don't know. And we're thinking that, but maybe that's true. Maybe they should comfort themselves.
but there's like home movies. And
sure.
She kept a lot of like scrapbooks. And my youngest sister found... her journals. She kept a journal from the time from the time she was like in third grade up until she got pregnant with me.
Wow.
And so we found like a box of those maybe 6 years ago.
Is it all sort of any sorted things?
I mean, you know, there's the one where she got married. She was dating and then got married to my dad.
Yeah.
And then got pregnant with me, and they were not planning to get pregnant.
Oh, wow.
So it's interesting to read your mom being like, I just were, you know, he's worried about it and he can't hear about it yet. And I feel like, you know, a pregnant teenager in high school, like,
oh,
this is not the plan.
She hadn't told him?
No, I think he knew, but he was like so stressed out that he was kind of like, look, just I don't tell me right now. Like, tell me in a few days or something. Based on what I read, like, I think they were very stressed out when they got pregnant with me.
Wow, that's sort of an interesting insight into any parent, whether dead or not, to see that private dialogue with herself, between herself, right?
Yeah. And I don't know that he read them. I know he asked to, but I don't think he actually read them. We all burned through them, of course. Yeah.
Are you guys keeping them from him?
You know, we have them.
Okay.
I mean, again, I gave him the college one at one point, but I just don't think he ever read it.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I would want to. Mm. If my spouse passed away, I don't think I'd want to read their diary from any part of our marriage. Not that she said anything terrible, but you know, I just thinking from my own perspective, I'm like, I don't know that I'd even want to chance it. Maybe because I've kept journals, so I know what I've written, and I'm like, I wouldn't want to.
Well, yeah, I think it is. I guess I don't know. I don't keep journals, but it's relative to the type of person you are. Some of us are. The only time I journaled, compulsively, was during my second divorce, you know, just to keep my sanity.
Yeah.
You know, but there was a lot of like dark thoughts going on then and a lot of fucking.
And would you want anyone to read that?
No, but I'm pretty open about a lot of it. I went through it, you know, because when you write a journal and you get through whatever you're journaling, you're kind of like, I bet you that stuff's pretty amazing.
Right.
And then you go read it. You're like, holy fuck, this is sad.
But when you first write it, you're like, I should publish this.
Yeah, this is deep shit. And it's just you repeating things day to day. It's crazy.
I just put the date and scribbled real hard on this page. That's nuts.
Didn't write much this day, but I showed up for it to say I'm not feeling like writing.
Yeah.
Well, as you get older and you have some hindsight, mm-hmm. and you definitely talk about it in your stand-up, I mean, what do you think the major effect it's had on you personally is?
Oh, I mean, I think you are always trying to impress somebody who no longer exists. Like, my biggest fear growing up is that my mom would not have liked me if she got to know me, and there's no way to find out if she would have or not. I mean, you assume that she would have.
Sure, and like, or she would have at least pretended to.
Right.
Long enough for you to eventually change into something she could.
Yes, she would have at least loved me out of obligation.
Right.
Until, you know, my brand became something she could get on board with. But that's why, like, if family members of mine from that side of the family, you know, watch my stand up and say things about, you know, we're very proud of you, I'm like, thank you so much. It feels like getting some of that from her that I never got. Uh-huh. And, you know, every good thing that happens in your life, there's a little voice in the back of your head going, oh, here's another thing that they're never going to see.
Oh, you really, you hear that. You feel that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the absence never kind of goes away.
I don't think so.
It's active. Yeah. Active absence.
Yeah. I said that to my grandma, who's my mom's mother, a couple years ago. I was just like, I just want to stop dealing with this. Like, when am I going to be past this? Because I would feel like, I feel good about that. Like, that's a thing that happened to me, but it doesn't control my life, and I don't think about it every single day, and I'm fine. And then, you know, there'd be 1 year that I thought about it every day, and it felt like it was affecting everything. And she said, you know, I don't think we're ever going to. I think it's just always going to be there in the back of your head, and it's always going to be something that we are dealing with a little bit, but you know, we're fine and we're all good and happy. And I think she has definitely fielded a lot of questions from me and my sisters about her over the years. And she is seemingly to me like the most at peace with it, which is incredible to me, because I can't imagine losing a child. I mean, I've never even had a child, but I can't imagine that.
And your father, it sounds like whatever grief he was going through, however he handled it, he was still there for you guys.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's funny. We've talked more recently about that period of time, which is helpful, because we were so young, we didn't really know exactly what he was going through. Mm-hmm. I think for him, he had four daughters, and he was suddenly by himself, and he was like, well, I can't stop. Like, I have to just keep going. Like, he told me once, he was like, I remember, like, the first day I took you guys to school, because it happened, like, the week before we went back to school.
Yeah.
And he's like, I got you guys all to school, and I came home, and I, like, laid down for a minute, and I just thought, okay, I can't just lay here. Like, if I
forever,
yeah, like, I have to just get up and clean and go to work, and like, I have to keep moving, and did for us in a huge way. And obviously, you know, met my now mom, my stepmom, and really, I think he kind of pushed it down for a long time, and
because
in a way,
because
he had a deal, and in a way, was already mourning while she was sick. Because, I mean, we knew she was going, and she's fading, and he's taking care of her for a year and just watching, you know, the person you love, like, you're watching them die slowly.
And in your head, you're preparing.
Yeah. So, I mean, it wasn't like she passed and he goes, oh, now we start mourning. Like, he'd already been there.
But you guys were just hanging on to hope, I imagine, like kids do.
He told me and my sister, who's closest to me in age, when we were 6 and 8, he was like, mom's not gonna make it, basically, and they gave her a month or so.
Really?
So I remember him telling us that.
Do you remember how you responded?
I just remember not feeling like it was real.
Right.
Which I think even after she died, I felt that way.
Sure, right. I could see that.
Yeah, because you're so young, you're like, this is a movie. I'm a Disney princess.
Right. Yeah, this doesn't happen to me. I mean, that's how I think people respond with anything as final and dire. Like, even like this pandemic, most people are like, come on.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm guilty of it. We're all guilty of it. It's like, how bad is it really? And now it's like, bad.
Yeah.
It's bad.
Oh, my best friend from childhood was calling me in like early February. Like she's like, I'm really concerned about this coronavirus thing. And I was like, it's the flu kills people every year. It's fine.
Yeah,
like,
that one. Not this quickly.
I know.
And not all at once.
Oh, cut to a month later. I'm calling her like, you guys are stocked up for how long? What else should I get? Do you guys have a gun yet? Like just, you know, totally on board now. I was like, I am so sorry. I told you this wasn't a big deal. She's like, it's okay.
Do you have a gun yet? So where does Jesus play into all this sadness and cancer and your upbringing? Because I know you really do talk about Christianity in a way that, you know, I've talked to other Christians that were, you know, grew up where it was a huge part of their life, might be the biggest part of their life. Mm-hmm. And you talk like one of those people.
Yeah, it was. Oh. It definitely was. I mean, I started doing stand-up in churches, you know.
But how did it play into, you know, dealing with the grief when you were a kid or your dad's grief? I mean, how does that work?
I feel like it was a source of comfort for my entire family. I feel like that's how people in my family deal with tragedy. They, you know, turn to God and they trust God. And that was definitely how I tried to deal with it as well. But I remember, like, the second my mom died, I remember thinking, everyone keeps talking about how we're going to see her again. And I don't know why I don't feel that way. But because everyone older and smarter than me is telling me that that's what's going to happen. So it must be what's going to happen. But I've never felt like that. I've never felt like, oh, we're gonna die and we'll all be together again and it'll be fine.
Yeah, I need more detail.
Yeah.
You know, like I wasn't a Christian, obviously, and I'm not a big believer in much, but like even the heaven idea, like we're gonna see them, but are we gonna have a place to hang out?
Right. How are they gonna recognize people who only met you when you were younger?
Yeah. I mean, are they gonna meet us there at the place? Are they waiting for it? Like,
do they know the rendezvous point?
Right, right. A lot of details.
How big is heaven?
yeah. Because is there neighborhoods that coincide with our neighborhood? Is everyone gonna be there? I don't know. But so you had at least doubts about the afterlife at that age, you felt that.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And for a while, I just kind of blindly was like, no, this is the thing. And
what brand of Christianity?
I don't even know.
Was it born again-y kind of, or like new Christian?
Whatever Christianity is where you had like kind of like a slightly hot worship leader leading the band, where it was kind of like, we're a cool church, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so sort of the new Christianity.
Yeah, I think so. That being said, you know, my dad is like very, very conservative and was like, the Bible is a textbook. So.
Right. But he doesn't identify as a Methodist, a Baptist, a Unitarian, Lutheran, or a Catholic. It's it's Christian.
Yeah. I think technically the church we grew up when we were young was Baptist, and then maybe the one we grew up in.
It's Christian-y and it's all encompassing.
Yes. Right. Yes, absolutely.
And the pastor was bordering on sort of charismatic self-help and, you know.
Yeah, definitely charismatic. Like, you could have been an actor, maybe. That kind of situation.
Sure. Yeah.
Got
the hustle.
Yeah, I mean, it is a performance every weekend. You gotta recognize a fellow live performer.
So at that age, when did you start, did you go to, was there a Christian school?
I didn't go to a Christian school. I mean, the Temecula is a pretty conservative Christian suburban area.
When you went down there?
9.
So he got remarried within a year?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they met shortly after my mom passed away.
So he needed somebody. But did you innately dislike her or question it?
No, I think I was excited about it because you're still in that sort of fantastical place of like, I get to be in a wedding and I'm 9 and I'm going to have a new mom and everything will be fixed.
Yeah.
And it was tough for a few years. It was an adjustment and she and I did not get along for a little while. And then I think at a certain point we kind of had it out and my dad said like, you guys have different love languages. And she just is not a very like touchy feely person. She's very much like acts of service and she'll think about you in other ways. She'll be like, oh, I bought you flip-flops because they broke at the beach, and like her way of hugging you.
Sure.
And we were used to being hugged. Like we went from like a stay-at-home mom to a very like successful hardworking like realtor mom who had a lot of money when we married her, and then all of a sudden had like five people in our house. Like, she went from being completely autonomous to you are now in a family of six overnight, which is, right. I mean,
it's a lot.
Oh, it's so much.
She didn't have kids?
She didn't have kids.
And
no.
They didn't have any more?
No, she can't have kids, which is probably good because we have enough of them.
There's enough kids.
Yeah, four kids. This is enough.
But they're still together and it worked out. And you got, and she, yeah. She raised you to a degree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She and my dad are so compatible. It's like made it hard to date as an adult sometimes where I go, how does anyone find someone like that? Like, they are genuinely best friends. They work together. They hang out all the time. And they are like on each other's team no matter what. And
your dad's a realtor now?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. So they're together all the time and they're the best couple I've ever seen.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
So when did shit start to go south with you and your faith? And because you say, you know, I know it's part of your story that you started doing stand up in church.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, so you're going to church every Sunday, and is there like a weekly school type of deal too? Or is there no?
No, it wasn't. We just went to public school. We weren't right. in like Christian school.
But
or
no,
anything.
There's no Sunday school or that kind of shit and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, Sunday, like that's just church on Sunday right. is when you're in, you know, right, middle school, high school.
So tell me what compelled you to stand up? Were you a stand up fan when you, because you started, how old were you when you first started doing stand up?
16.
That's a little freakish. Usually people who start when they're 16, they get paraded by the industry as like, look at this 16-year-old do stand-up. And they have 10 minutes and then they disappear because they couldn't write another.
Right. Well, thank God I started in churches where nobody was watching you.
That's how it works. So when, how old were you when your dad and yourself took that class?
16.
Oh, that was
it? Yeah, yeah.
And whose class was it?
This Christian comic named Nazareth. Was teaching it.
A Christian comic with one name,
mm-hmm.
and it's Nazareth?
Yeah.
How big is the Christian comedy scene?
It's not very big. There's
is
not
it
a
just
ton.
Nazareth?
It's no, I would say maybe there's like 10,
what
10 guys and ladies that I...
Now, I think I've seen some of that, but I mean, how much of it was Christian-based? I mean, is it just
oh,
about
a
being...
lot. Mine wasn't. I never did.
But it's
like
not
church.
Just. It's not just about being clean or respecting family values. It's, you know, Jesus is in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
they're performing in exclusively churches, so of course you're gonna.
So they're sanctioned. They're valid. They're okayed by the church. Mm-hmm. So it almost becomes an extension of Jesus' education.
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly part of the class where he was like, "Here's how you know if it's appropriate to end your set with an altar call." You know, like there's some of that in there.
What's an altar call?
It's when you basically do the whole prayer of like, if you're here tonight and you're feeling God move in your heart, come up to the front and we'll pray with you and we'll, you know, get you saved.
That
basically.
Was a potential closer
yeah.
for a Christian comic.
Yeah. If you're bombing, altar call.
Yeah, always go to the yeah. altar call. You can't lose. Yeah.
Yeah, I think once I started doing stand-up in clubs and meeting people that I just wasn't exposed to in, you know, my very conservative, sheltered
but like,
childhood.
Wait, but tell me about like these other Christian comics. So I imagine how long were you in that world of doing Christian comedy? 16 to what? For like a couple of years or?
Couple years where it was mostly
gigs.
That. Yeah, but then I was doing the occasional church show still up until I was 22, up until like 4 years
okay,
ago.
Okay, so what tell me some of I'd like to know how faith fits into some of their jokes. I guess I could just go online and look, but like mm-hmm. for yourself, what kind of jokes were you doing at that time that you would call specifically Christian jokes?
I didn't have any. I was very much like, I just want to be clean. I don't want to do any jokes about church. But it makes sense why these guys have so many jokes about church in their act, because they're only performing in church.
And they're getting paid.
And they're getting paid a lot. So,
it's
you
part
know,
of the hustle.
Right. And everybody in that church goes to church, obviously. So that's, you
so
know.
So are they there, you know, they're like the extra added thing on a Sunday, or does the church say like it's Saturday night comedy night?
Saturday night comedy night.
Oh, so there's a whole circuit.
Yeah.
And these guys rake it in because, you know, they got a built-in audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then you got to make sure that you are not making any mistakes. That world is so strict in a way that, you know, the secular world is not.
Yeah.
Like, you can get canceled as a church comedian for even just having sex. Like,
within that community.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Like, you know, and it is, you know, it's like you are kind of... You're not just a comedian coming into a church. You're coming in going, I'm the thing that you want.
Right.
Like, I'm, you know,
I'm a good Christian.
Pure, and I'm a good Christian, yeah. And I have all these values. And some people who perform in churches are absolutely, totally, authentically that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some people who, you know, I suspect may not be. And for me, when I did Last Comic Standing when I was 20, 21. And they were like, we want to do a backstory on you about being a Christian comic. And I was like, I really don't want to be billed as a Christian comic. I was like, I'd really prefer not to be. And they were like, no, totally. We get it. We're just going to say you like started in one and we'll film you at one.
Yeah,
and it's
right.
Your backstory.
Right.
And then, of course, it comes out and it's like edited. Like, I'm the only Christian comic here. And
right.
You're like, oh, all right.
Oh, really? That happened?
Yeah, that happened. And then like I did maybe another year of...
Well, you had to.
A few church gigs, yeah, because you're staying alive, money. Mm. And then at a certain point...
When did you start getting paid?
To do churches?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, like, so early, like the first few months. Like, they were letting you do like 15 minutes in front of 500 people.
For
and
money.
You'd been on stage less than 15 times.
So that was sort of, that's how you got your chops.
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely...
like, you didn't have to do like an open mic thing...
No, I mean, I did open mics in San Diego once I was 18 and I could.
Right, but I mean, but you already had bits.
Yeah, I had bits and I was comfortable on stage.
Right, because you had all this experience with the churches.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So that's what I'm saying is that you paid some pretty, it was a gift to be able to, in some ways to, I guess you had limitations, right? So you could only write within a context. Like you can only...
Yeah.
Express yourself to a certain degree, but as long as you stayed in that lane, you had access to these huge audiences.
Yes.
So you could really figure out where and how and, you know, to get laughs just on a basic level.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, you go, I don't want to be under this sort of scrutiny for my whole life where, like, I am... being fired from a church gig because I tweeted something with innuendo in it. Yeah. That was like the last church gig I had where I was opening for a big Christian comic.
Which one?
I don't know if I should say. I mean, you could figure it out if you looked online, probably.
But you're not saying anything bad about him.
That's true. I'm not. I mean, they fired me, but I don't blame them.
No, but, yeah.
I was opening for Tim Hawkins, who's like a huge Christian comedian. And I tweeted a joke that was like sexual innuendo that I ended up doing on Conan a few years later. But
yeah.
I remember his tour manager called me and was just like, hey, like, we think you're great and you know that, but like, we think it would just be best if we took you off the spring tour dates.
Cause
like, we have kids in our audience and, you know, we do songs on YouTube about homeschooling and whatnot. Like, we have to think about our audience and we can't have, you know, we can't be like endorsing somebody.
So you lost a few gigs.
Yeah, yeah. And at that point, I've never been fired from anything.
Right.
So...
You were 20?
No, at that point, I was 20, 21 or 22.
Uh-huh.
And I remember I talked to my manager and I was like, hey, like, I just can't do any more churches ever again. And it took a few more times of them going, but it's this much money. I'm like, you can't even tell me how much money it is.
Yeah.
Like, I can't do it anymore because I feel like I am tricking these people. I feel like I am... going into these spaces unsure of what I believe and maybe I want to start swearing occasionally in a comedy club, which up until that point I hadn't been. But I'm like, if I accidentally say something on stage and a video goes up and they get sent a video of me saying asshole, like, I don't want to worry about getting
the rest of my life
blackballed
from the only work I'm getting.
Yeah. And there were things I wanted to talk about, like darker subjects and whatever else. Like, I was in clubs. Like, I didn't want to have to be watching every move I made and every word I said.
Did this coincide with the crisis of faith, or were you over that before?
I think it was kind of all at the same time. And I think when you are in that world and your family is all in that world, yeah. you want to hold on to it as sure. long as you can.
Yeah.
So it was definitely a few years of me going, I'm just not going to think about that right
yeah,
now.
Right.
But I don't know how I feel about it. And maybe I'm still doing that to a certain extent, but what
about belief in God or just the nature of the faith you were brought up in?
I think belief in God. I mean, I'm in a place now where I can't wrap my head around anybody going, I figured it out what happens.
Right.
I know exactly what happens. It's right here. It's written down.
Right.
So we can all just calm down. We know exactly what's coming. Because for me, I'm like, but nobody actually knows. And you talk to devout Christians and they're like, but I know. And you're
right.
like, but you don't though. And you're
right.
like, no, I know. And you're like, I can't talk to you.
Right.
you know, like,
yeah, no changing their mind.
Yeah, but there are some Christians who are like, yeah, we don't know. And you should, yeah. you know, search and doubt and yeah, have all those yeah. things. So,
but you'll be back.
No, right. Yes, exactly. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. We'll see you in a little while.
Right.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, I like the idea of there being something greater than all of us. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I grew up with that. I, in times like these, I'm certainly like, okay, maybe we start praying again. I
yeah.
don't know, you know? So I wouldn't say that I'm, you know, like an atheist now
right.
or anything
no,
by any
yeah, yeah.
by any so, stretch, but.
So you were 22 when you said no more churches.
Mm-hmm.
And you did churches from like 16 to 22, basically.
Yeah.
So when you were coming up like that, I mean, who were the people, outside of listening to my podcast, who were the people that were most influencing you and, you know, kind of making you know that you were doing the thing you wanted to do?
I mean, Pete Holmes' podcast came out
yeah.
a little bit after that, and that was helpful for me to listen to somebody who was also kind of going through, like, crisis of faith stuff
yeah,
and
yeah.
was a comedian, because
right.
there wasn't really anybody else that mm-hmm. I knew of or to look to as, like, oh, they were a Christian, and
right.
now they're transitioning into just, like, a comedian, you
yeah,
know?
Right.
So that was helpful. I mean, I opened for Brian Regan for a few years.
Really?
Yeah, he has like a group of people who use, and I was in that
clean,
rotation for a little
family
while.
Fun.
Yeah, he just found me on YouTube. It was
uh-huh.
so random. It took me like a couple gigs to be like, hey, how did you find
So you're doing big rooms.
Yeah, and then like I was featuring.
You, like, you started doing like arenas.
I mean, yeah, in theaters,
yeah.
and that was, yeah, I guess that was fairly early. That was like 20, 21,
like
you, 22.
Like, but your first gigs, like, it's like when you started, you're like 500 people is not unusual.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
Doing open mics was much harder. You're like, there's five people here and they all hate me
yeah.
and themselves.
They're all friends of the next guy.
Right, yeah. Yeah. yeah.
So you did on and off stuff with Regan for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's certainly great to watch as
oh
a
my gosh.
Craftsman.
Amazing. And like the nicest person and, you know, introduces himself to everybody at the theater and is just like very humble and
uh-huh.
personable. And yeah, and then I featured for Bert on the road for a little while before
Kreischer?
I started headlining. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, and you can't open for like two more different acts
That's
than
for sure. yeah.
Regan
yeah.
and Bert.
Shirt on, shirt off.
Right. So I feel like I was really lucky in that I got to, you know, do like a cold 20 minutes super clean in a theater and then the next weekend go, you know, do 25 for like a rowdy comedy club sold out audience.
Yeah, but where were you putting your stuff together? How were you building? Was it all on the road or were you going to mics? Did you have a home club here? Because like I would have known you if you were at the store, but you're not at the store.
I was not at the store. I only got passed at the store like a year and a half ago.
Uh-huh.
But I was passed everywhere else. So
where,
I
like
was
the Factory and the Improv.
Yeah, the Factory was the first place I think that passed me, and like, you know, Ice House and Improv and Comedy Magic. Like I was passed everywhere else. So for me, I was like, why would I?
When you were 21.
Like 22, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So by the time I was doing development spots, I was like, why would I like kind of leave the night open for 6 minutes?
Yeah, who cares?
And,
right, when
yeah.
you can do 15 to 20 and try
yeah.
some shit for a real audience.
Yeah, and I was kind of like, all right, if I get successful enough, maybe he'll pass
so
me.
So now, did you get passed out all these places? You know, how did you get in front of these people? How'd they find you? Do you have good management?
No, I just got put on like independently booked shows and
oh, okay.
then you know like
oh, and then they
Jamie happened to be there that
right.
Wednesday
oh, yeah,
night
yeah,
and
yeah.
saw me and was
right.
like you can call in like I got passed at the Factory before Last Comic and then I think everywhere else was either right before or around that time
because they could
or
see
after.
You were like you know you were congealed
certainly helped yeah,
yeah you were like you know you're tight
right yeah
and you had a, you know it's because I can't imagine the you know how much it really made a difference to, you know, to be comfortable just stepping on a stage in front of 500 people when you're 16 and having that opportunity over and over again to come to the factory, as daunting as it may be, it's definitely not 500 people.
No, but it's way harder.
Yeah, because they can see you. You know, and they're not just sort of blindly supportive because you're a nice Christian girl.
Yeah, and they're eating and
But you still, like, you know, you put together like a skill set that mm-hmm. you know, must have really kind of landed.
Yeah, I mean,
and your material's good.
Yeah, hopefully
it all worked out.
It looks like it is. I mean, sort of. We're all. Who knows if we can do live shows after this, but.
Right. But then, so after when you were 22, like how much of a difference does Last Comic Standing make for you?
I don't know that it made a huge difference for me. I think it was just sort of helpful to have a TV credit, you know, but I also got like, I booked like 50 colleges at doing NACA.
You did the NACA thing?
Like a few months before.
That's good living for a year or two,
yes.
Huh?
Yeah.
And so if you land those schools, you know, which you did, you landed like, what did you say, 40 or 50?
Yeah.
Oh, so, you know, that's real work, man.
Yeah, that's how I went full time. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And do you still do it?
Not really. Occasionally. I haven't done a college in a while. I mean, I was definitely aware of the fact that I was very young. And that was probably part of why I was doing well at colleges.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because, you know, you're talking about things that they are also experiencing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then you, like, I was also living with my parents at the time when I first auditioned for NACA.
Yeah.
And then the next few years I wasn't, and I was paying my own bills. And once you start paying your own bills and living in the real world, you start to realize, like, oh, a lot of these kids at these colleges are freshmen. Like, a lot of them are 17, 18.
They're at the show because they can't go off campus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't even know what I would do.
Yeah.
Like, they're kids.
Yeah. And they get real uncomfortable with dark jokes or sex jokes or offensive. Like, they're very nervous because they haven't been to a live comedy show before, a lot of them.
Mm.
And it's not their fault. Like, when people talk about, oh, college kids are so sensitive and they'll cancel you for whatever and they just want to be offended for other people. And it's like, they just haven't lived that much.
Right,
it's
right.
not their fault.
Right,
like,
yeah,
a lot
yeah.
of them aren't stand-up comedy fans. Like,
they don't know what they feel when they feel it even.
Yeah, and a lot of them are, you're doing, like, you're there the first week of school and none of these kids know each other.
Yeah.
Like, this is...
That's a tough gig.
Yeah. Yeah. So I kind of felt like I phased out of it and was starting to go, I don't know what to say.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out, like, so you shot the special, what, 6 months ago?
Yeah, November.
Because I'm just trying to figure out, because, like, the set is so expansive and so tight that you definitely weren't putting that set together in 20-minute increments.
No, I was headlining. Yeah.
Yeah, so when did that start?
That probably started, was I 22?
Uh-huh.
Maybe 22, 23? It so all kind of happened around the same time.
When you were opening for Bert and...
I was featuring for Bert for... I don't know, maybe like 4 months or something. It wasn't that long of a time before I kind of started headlining. I think I did Conan and Just for Laughs and like got a development deal all the same year. And that was like when I was starting to headline.
That's interesting. They barely give out development deals anymore. Who was that with?
ABC.
Oh,
yeah.
And what was the pitch?
I mean, we had all these meetings at networks after JFL and I went in.
Is that when you started with Levity?
Like a year before that.
Okay.
I guess
I should explain that. I don't know if I've explained that before. So Levity is Hartman's company, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm explaining it to my listeners, which
I rarely do.
And Levity is, I think Hartman is part of the group that owns most of the improvs. So there's a line in there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So a lot of Levity clients run through the improvs
mm-hmm.
2, 3, maybe 4 times a year,
mm-hmm.
you know, across the country. It's a good connection to have to mm-hmm. at least not only get your dues paid, but, you know, make a good living.
Yes.
Okay. So you're meeting with networks.
Mm-hmm. And I went in just trying to be kind of funny about my life and my childhood, and at the end they were like, we want to make the show. And I was like, what show? And
we'll set you up with a writer.
Right. And there were a few different places that we were talking to, and we ended up choosing ABC. And I loved the people I worked with, and we wrote what they wanted, which was a multicam sitcom.
Did you meet a bunch of writers and choose one, mm-hmm. that kind of deal?
Yeah. They were great. They were amazing. And they really helped me shape it because I didn't know what I was doing.
And what was the angle? You were a Christian comic who was
I wanted wasn't a out. Comic. I didn't want to be a comic on it, but it was just about the idea was that I, you know, moved in with my sisters and we were all trying to like figure out who we were apart from this like sheltered upbringing.
Right.
My parents were characters on the show. I think we did as good a job as we could have for what it was, like that format.
Sure.
I wasn't super passionate
Three
about
camera.
It. Yeah, I wasn't super passionate about it. But after that didn't go at ABC, they were kind of like, all right, so where else do you, we can go do it with this network now if you want. And I was like, I mean.
So I'm going to do some stand-up?
Yeah, I'm like, why? Yeah. If I was nervous that it would go and I would have to cancel road dates because I was like, I'm trying to get good at headlining. Like, when am I going to have time to do that if we're making a sitcom?
So in Montreal, were you a new face?
Mm-hmm.
So done with Christian stuff, done with colleges. Now you're just doing improvs.
Mostly, yeah.
Headlining improvs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's where you got real tight, mm-hmm. real solid. Got the length in.
Right.
Built it out.
Yes.
Do the hour 15, no problem.
Right, yeah.
Got a big closer.
I mean, you know, you hope so.
Yeah.
There was certainly some imposter syndrome when I got the special with Netflix. I was like, I mean, I submitted the hour because I was headlining and my reps were like, just submit the hour, you know? And I was like, well, just so you know, I'm expecting to get the half hour, if anything, because I had done the 15 with Netflix. And so I was just hoping to get the half hour next. Yeah, yeah.
How long between the 15 and the hour? How many years?
Like a year and a half, uh-huh. I guess.
Yeah, so you had most of the hour when you did the 15.
Yeah, I had a good chunk of it, for sure. Yeah. And then, you know, the 15, obviously you retire after it's on Netflix, so that didn't go into it.
So now you're the hour person.
Yeah, seem to be one of them, yeah.
And who are you finding in your audience? How's your draw? Did it make a big difference?
I only did one road weekend after it came out.
But before though, even were you like, because like I was not a guy that built up an audience on the road. I don't know how many times they were running you through which improvs, mm-hmm. but were you somebody who could sell tickets?
Not in any like significant way. I don't think like I wasn't like selling out weekends or anything.
Right.
The Netflix 15 definitely helped.
Uh-huh.
And doing, you know, a few late night sets and whatnot, that stuff definitely was helpful. And I was seeing people come out and come up to me afterward, like, we've been following you since this, or we saw your Netflix, or we saw you on Last Comic. And,
right.
There were people that were coming out specifically to see me, but it was not most of the audience. And I still don't know. That's kind of the interesting thing about right now is, you know, normally at this point, I could go out and see. I did one weekend 2 days after the special came out, and people were coming out from that already, which was nice.
And then the pressure's already on. So you got a whole new hour?
Yeah.
So when you shot the special, you were sitting on what, 40? 30?
That I wasn't using?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was sitting on maybe like 20 that I felt like I could have put in and didn't. And then, you know, you have all the other stuff you're working on.
Right, so you're able to start folding it out, you know, kind of like making it bigger, adding the shit. So you have a at least an hour in 6 months, you put it together.
Yeah.
From what you didn't use to the new shit.
Yeah.
Working it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was like, oh, I should take a vacation after I film this. And everyone's like, no, you need a new hour. I'm like, oh, okay, let's get back on the road.
The way I did it was, like, I knew that I've been working that hour that for like a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
Like letting that stuff kind of simmer and start to come together and form, and like you can really see it. You know, I can see it in the work in the hour 20 or the hour 73 minutes, 74 minutes, so hour 15. What'd you do? Hour 13, hour 10?
You know, I think it's an hour right on the dot. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was afraid to do any more or any less.
I always push it. I'm like, what's the most I can do?
Yeah.
And they're like 73.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay. I'll do 73 because like I'm touring, I'm doing like an hour 45, right? So I got to make that into 73. So now I've got like a half hour or so, but I always lose shit. But by the time I did the special, I just wanted to make sure I had made enough money off of that hour.
Mm-hmm.
that I knew I was going to do. Like, after I taped it, I went out and did another part of the tour just because I knew come, like, 2 weeks ago, it's over.
Yes.
So I'm like, I had these months, and I'm like, why aren't we, let me go make some more money off of this.
Oh, that's a good point.
After this, off of this hour.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I'm like, I built it. It's really good. And there's a bunch of cities we didn't do. Let's just fucking knock a few out. So I did another 9 or 10 dates just before.
Just that hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I didn't think to do that because I'd been doing some of those jokes a really long time. And
right.
Some of them I had been doing, you know, a few months.
But it sounds like you were working a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Like every
weekend.
But
so you didn't think that once you taped it, you didn't do any more of sets or you didn't do any more full hours?
I never did that hour again. I did. Was in Royal Oak doing Comedy Castle.
In Detroit?
Yeah. Like a week after, maybe a week and a half after we filmed it. And I did maybe like 40% of that hour.
Yeah.
And then from that weekend on, I tried to do as little as possible.
But there was only places I could go. Were places I hadn't gone with it.
Right.
You know, like, because there have been different forms of it. But I always make sure I do, if I'm headlining, I always make sure I'll do at least an hour and a half, hour 45. Because I don't really know what people have seen or what they haven't seen. I'm not that tight about it until it's in the can.
Uh-huh.
You know, so there's a year and a half there where I'm like, did I do this last time I was here? I can't remember the fucking last time I was here. So it's a little tricky.
Do you have like one opener?
Yeah, I only use one opener.
Yeah, and how much time do they do?
Yeah, 20.
Okay, so it's like a 2-hour show.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if they've seen part of it, it's like, oh, so you saw 30 minutes
of two
hours?
But, you know, people are dicky.
Right.
You know, like it happened in England and it pissed me off so much. I don't know if I'm ever going to go there again.
Really?
Like I went back and I was still working out shit. And that set evolved so much over the year. You know, that it was a different set.
Mm-hmm.
And there was more, and I knew I'd been there with some of that set. And I did another 45 to 50 on top of stuff that was so different than they'd first seen it. And one woman complained, and I'm like, fuck that country. That was my response. Because you know it could happen.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be that guy that repeats himself. I don't want to be that guy.
Right.
But I took the gig. It was my own fault. But I also knew I had another 50 minutes.
Yeah.
So, they're going to get double the show.
Well, and if you had come in and only done the 50 minutes, she wouldn't have complained. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah,
I gave you twice as much show.
Yeah, no, no. Yeah,
you got to look at me twice as long.
Yeah, no, it was just too much for her to bear.
I
guess I shouldn't punish the entire country.
But I mean,
maybe none of us are going anywhere ever again.
Yeah, I know. I was about to say, I'm like, we might never get to go to England, any of us.
It could happen.
I don't know. What do you think?
Really?
Because, do you think...
Well, I'm dumb. I think that, I don't know how long it'll take, but I imagine we'll get through this.
Yeah.
But, how hard is it going to be to travel? What restrictions are going to be permanently in place in some sort of authoritarian way because they've already got them up and working because of this thing? I don't know.
Yeah. Are you worried about people being able to, come to a theater and watch a live performance of any kind?
Well, I mean, if this plays out like other things, there's going to be a lot of tragedy and horror and sick people and deaths. But I assume if, they don't shut down science, they'll figure out a vaccine or a process.
Right.
And, these things seem to they kind of run their course, usually, eventually.
Yeah.
You know, I would assume that that would happen.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Everything's so out of balance. Who knows?
Yeah.
I just know that, I'm glad this new special was sort of like a kind of life's work for me. Like, I feel like this one is I really kind of, all the stuff that I've been working on my entire career, ideas and things that have, kind of been part of what I talk about, I've got closure on them.
Right. So you're like, if that's the last thing I did,
yes.
I'm good with it.
Exactly.
A little bit. That's a nice place to be.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to die.
Right.
But you know.
Oh, I wasn't even thinking dying. If stand-up is no longer a job.
I'm okay.
Yeah, you're good.
I did it. I really feel that proud of that special.
Yeah, yeah. You're interviewing Leonardo DiCaprio now. Like, you don't even need to interview comedians anymore.
I'd much rather interview comedians. I wouldn't say, that thing with Brad Pitt and Leo was, not a traditional
right.
WTF. It was I mean, sort of like, yeah.
Do you listen? Did you ever listen back to it? Like, Brad Pitt watched my show how many times?
I know, three times. Well, I knew that because I'd run into him in weird places at an art show once. And then it's some benefit that I did.
Uh-huh.
And he had told me both times that he'd watched it. And I didn't know that it totaled out on three. I think the deeper story around that was that he was going through a difficult time. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, he was trying to get sober and other things. And that somehow comforted him, my insanity.
So you saved Brad Pitt.
A little bit.
Is what you're saying.
I think I helped. I hope he's still saved. You know, I don't know, but I do think I provided a service.
Yeah, yeah.
Not unlike for you, from what you say, I helped you understand that there was a career trajectory that you could engage in because these other people did it.
Yeah.
Like who were, when you listen to WTF, who were some of the people you're like, oh gosh.
I mean, I was trying to remember. I almost went back and, but you got to scroll so far back on Stitcher to see who the first ones were. So I don't know, but back when you first started, it was like every episode comic. Was a stand-up comedian.
Yeah,
so I mean, you know,
right.
there would be people who popped up where I'm like, oh my God, Kathleen Madigan or whatever, you know?
Right.
And hearing them talk to you for an hour was so much more informative than like even listening to their stand-up.
Oh, of course.
Because, you know, you're not going to learn
You can only learn style from watching stand-up.
Exactly, yeah. And even like I learned who a lot of people were by watching Last Comic Standing when I was a kid. So listening to those people talk on a long form podcast is so much more helpful than watching them, you know, do a talking head on a reality show.
Sure. Or even on Conan.
Yeah.
To hear me and Bamford in a car.
Yes. Oh my God. Yes.
Her talking about her morbid thought syndrome.
Yes.
Yeah. It's helpful. Yeah. Look at these are weird people and I'm weird. So yeah. I can do it. So your dad didn't, he didn't continue with the stand up after he took the class.
No. Yeah. It was just a fun thing for us to do for 6 weeks. I think he did one. We did like a show in like a hotel once. After we took the class, and that was the only time I think he ever did stand up.
Not for him, huh? He wasn't cut out for it.
No, I don't think he had any desire to like do it
really do
as
it.
A career. Yeah. Why would he? You know, he's got a full life and a hot wife and a great career. Why would he throw it all away?
But you're good with them. That's good because, like, you know, I'm not sure that's exactly clear. And you're good with your dad. He's good with your work.
I wouldn't say he's good with my work. I think that they are, I think that they're proud of me. It's been an interesting adjustment over the last few years, because I did kind of tell them, like, I am not clean anymore.
Yeah.
But there's a difference between I am not clean anymore and seeing it on television.
Did you literally said to your parents, like, I'm dirty.
Basically, yeah, I was like, I swear, like, I have some jokes that are, you know, I just, to warn you. And I mean, they haven't seen me perform. The only times they've seen me perform live in the last 4 years is opening for Regan.
Queen.
And yeah, and then they saw me on The Tonight Show the first time I did it. And
Jimmy?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And then a week after, you know, the Netflix 15 came out and they watched it and didn't contact me for a little bit. So.
Because that was the only dirty one.
Yeah, that was the first. That was like the first TV thing that was
racy.
I was swearing in it. It's not even really racy. It really isn't. It's like pretty clean. I think I said like two swear words.
But now you're pretty like, you know, you explore sexual ideas, sexual experience, you know, love. You do talk about the things that are ridiculous about being brought up Christian, and you know, it's so you don't really know. It's not a great feeling at home.
I mean, I kind of told them beforehand, like, I think my dad watched my last Conan and didn't say anything about it. And then
that's the worst, though.
Yeah, I know. And then I said something. Well, I told him I was going to be on Conan, and he just, like, changed the subject. And I was like, all right. And then I talked to him, like, a month after I did it, and I said something like, yeah, I don't know if you saw that. And he goes, I did. I didn't like it. And I said, you know, you don't have to watch my stand-up. Like, it won't hurt my feelings. If I weren't your daughter, you wouldn't watch me. Like, I'm not for you, you know, so it's, I had to kind of separate that. Like, of course you want your parents to approve of everything you do, but you also get to a point where you're like, if I saw a couple their age, from, you know, a suburban area like they are from, walk out of one of my shows, would it keep me up at night? No, probably not. So once I came to that, I was like, you guys don't have to watch it. It's fine. And I don't know if they watched the special. I assume they probably did. I ran all the jokes about my dad past him before I filmed it.
And how'd that go?
He said he really appreciated it and that it meant a lot to him that I did it. I also wasn't like, is that okay? But I...
You didn't ask him that.
I didn't ask him that. But right. I said, these are the jokes about you. This is how I say them. You know, I didn't send him a video because maybe, I don't know, maybe that would have... felt less personal, but I'm like, these are the bits exactly as I say them, because I didn't want friends of his to quote jokes about him back to him after my special came out and him to like not know what they were talking about.
Oh, right, right,
or
right.
Have a game of telephone, you know, happen where they butcher
something.
Yeah,
horrible, right.
They butcher one of my bits and it's like, did you see that bit about Taylor hating you? And it was like, what? So that was kind of what I was trying to make sure didn't happen.
You left your stepmom out of it.
No, there are no jokes about her in the special. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting what you choose to do. Like I have some issues with that, and I've been incredibly hard on my parents, in my stand up over the years.
Do you run those jokes past them before?
Fuck no.
I was gonna ask. Yeah. So they just kinda see it when it comes out?
The only time I've been really hard on my dad, and I've done the jokes in front of them. Yeah, I'm fortunate in that my dad can take a certain amount of abuse. He just likes the attention.
Right.
When I wrote a book, there was some stuff in there that really fucked with him, and it got bad, and he was mad at me for a long time, and wanted compensation even.
Whoa.
Yeah, it got heavy, but this last hour there was one or two lines in there about my mother where I'm like, oh, man, is it worth it?
Yeah.
See, that's the fucked up thing is that it really comes down to who am I? How much of this is my story? This is my fucking freedom. Can I handle doing this and live with it?
Yes.
And most of the time I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
I think my mom, she was like, this special, she was like, I even put up with the things you said about me. But she didn't like the Mike Pence bit. She didn't like that last bit.
Really?
But not because she has any...
She took more issue with that than the bits about her, is what you're
for
saying.
For sure, yeah. I think it was just how dirty it was.
Right.
And my mom's no prude, but I mean, that thing's a little gnarly.
It's, Pence aristocrats bit.
It is. It is kind of... Someone else compared it to that. I guess it is that. How far can this go?
Yeah.
But I've made a lot of choices about that in relationships and stuff. But I think it's really about, is it fair, right?
Yes. Yeah. Mm. I think I had a joke that I was doing about something my grandma told me about herself that I was doing on the road. And before I filmed the special, I ran it by her and she laughed. And then 2 days later, she texted me and was like, I can't stop thinking about that. It makes me sound like this and I don't love that. And I was like, it's gone.
Yeah.
It's totally gone.
Yeah.
Because that was something that she told me about her.
Right.
It had nothing to do with me. It wasn't something she said to me that hurt me. It was her story. So that I was like, of course I'm not going to do that.
That's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
Right.
But with my dad, with the joke I do about telling him I was suicidal and him saying, go ahead and kill yourself.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, that's something that I've done EMDR therapy on. That's mine.
Yeah.
I get to do a bit about it and
you got right.
Yeah, I get to feel better about it and I also
because you did that.
I did, yes.
And he did that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I also get to cushion it as much as I think is appropriate, which I did do because I can't imagine being a parent and everything you ever did, every mistake you ever made is now being, aired out on a major streaming platform.
Right.
I can't imagine that. So I did try to cushion it with, my parents are great and they did their best and, nobody's parents are perfect and all that. But, that joke, as funny as it is and how proud of it I am, came from a very real place of excruciating pain for years and years.
Right.
And was something I worked through in very extensive therapy. So I felt like I earned that.
Yeah. No, I agree. There is that line though where there's some stuff that's told to you, my mom, I've read emails from my, or texts from my mother on on stage because I just can't not do it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of wrong.
Right.
Because in some ways, that's like a thing. Well, I guess that's not the same example, but if they tell you something about themselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's their trip. You know what I mean? You got to be like, yeah, it's funny, but like, yeah, I mean, it was told to me in confidence, or it's their story or whatever. That's a different decision than my mother with her emojis. I mean, I think that's fair game.
Right. Yeah.
You sort of explain that, sort of like you want to make it clear that they did the best they could. I used to do a joke about, like, you know, when they say that to you, they didn't. There's no way. I mean, if you really think about it, how is that the best? It's almost like they didn't even know what the fuck they were doing. They were winging it.
Yeah, but I think that's what they mean when they say, I did my best. You go, you did what you knew to do, and maybe you didn't know that much at that point.
I guess, but I don't even know, like, yeah, but there was no, the attention paid was not like, you know, how do we do this right? It's sort of like, well, how do I fit this into my life? I've got shit I got to do.
Right.
Like, there's got to be a way just to keep these fucking kids from, like, driving me crazy. Like,
right.
It's not even a noble attempt.
Yeah.
They didn't do the best at anything. They just, like, they did what they could.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's
some
all
parents,
it is.
Some parents are better than others. Yeah. But so somehow or another, this thing doesn't add this weight to your relationship with them that's not good.
It does. Mm-hmm. It comes and goes, I think, that weight. You know, we still haven't talked about my special. Like,
isn't that fucked up, though? It's weird that the thing I don't get is that, like, you know, to me, there should not be any problem. Like, to me, it's like, you're a success. You've done something challenging. You're being rewarded for it. And you're good at it, and you're unique. And, you know, you tell us all those things should sort of override them being personally embarrassed.
Right.
Right. Because that's really what it comes down to. It's not like, you know, it's not some sort of judgment, a Christian judgment or not Christian or this or that. It's like they're embarrassed.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. That you're, you know, either you're talking about them that way, or that you're like who you are publicly.
Yeah.
Because they can't control that. So that's the problem. She's out there making noise about us.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly that. And it's, you know, I did a joke about my dad, you know, not thinking like gay people should be allowed to get married on Conan like 4 years ago or whatever.
Right.
And ran it past him beforehand. And he was like, that's funny. That's fine. And then like 2 days after, he was like, you know, never talk about me on stage again. And we had to like have a talk about it.
All of a sudden, like the gay people in his life, if there are any, were like, you monster.
I don't know if anyone even, I was like, did people say something to you? He's like, no, but it's not. You know,
I don't want people to know that I'm that person.
No, I don't think it's that. I think he was, I guess, understandably upset that I was making fun of his beliefs. And and he was like, why am I being, you know, raked across the coals for my beliefs? And I was just like, I just think you are wrong. I was like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, I think you are wrong about that, and in a moral way.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of probably a turning point a little bit for me, where I'm like, just don't watch my stuff.
Right. And because you can't reconcile with that. It's like we said earlier, when you talk to one of those type of Christians, they're not going to change.
Absolutely. And like, again, I've never had kids. I don't know what that feels like to just have them out in the world making noise, as you said. And not having any control over that, not having any platform to be like, actually, this is how it went down. Like, your side is not even a part of it, which is why I feel like I have to be so careful, you know, trying to kind of balance it when I do make jokes about them.
I don't know. I think you should shift your disposition to more of like, you had it coming. You had it coming.
Starting now, I will.
Yeah, you know, I get you're upset, but yeah, you had it. Come on.
No, I mean, I really, again, as someone who has dated comedians, I'm like, I think that's good. I think it's good for comedians to date other comedians just so they know how it feels to be talked about on stage, you know, in a personal way. I mean, obviously, we are more understanding of it because you think. Do you think you're just as sensitive as your mom would be?
I think we're all sensitive, but what we've learned as comedians is to sort of suck it up and just like build a callus or get some sort of chronic kind of mild PTSD around, you know, what we can and can't take. You know, I just think that there's an open, I do, the thing about dating comedians or living in this community where there really is no boundaries around ideas, it's an amazing place to live, and it's an amazing community of people. But, you know, there's no kind of moral precedence that, you know, when we're alone, that we're not going to fuck with and stuff.
Right.
Right. So there's a lot out in the open there. But yeah, I get like the ones I was involved with, or it was really just the one. I would never do it again. But, you know, speaking publicly, if someone you're with speaks publicly about you, I'm with someone now who, you know, talks about, she's a public person, she's a director. But I always sort of like, I'm always like, oh, do you have to, that's, you know,
yeah,
that's a little private, isn't it? But like, what am I going to say?
Yeah. Oh, you especially.
Yeah, right. I'm in no position to go like, could you not maybe, you know, talk about what I do when I'm crying
right.
by myself?
Oh. Yeah, I mean, this is off the record. Like, yeah, you have to do that during fights almost.
Right,
like,
yeah. I'm about to say something, yeah. But I don't want it to come out in interviews.
Yeah, which my parents have said that to me during that, and please don't do a bit about this. And I'm like, how would you even think I could? And then as the longer I've done this, I'm like, oh, I understand.
Yeah,
what you would
they
think
assume that.
That
everything is like you're going.
Someone said that to me at a funeral once. A neighbor's husband died, and we went to his funeral, and she came up to us crying. We're like, we're so sorry. And she goes, you're not going to put this in your thing. And I was why would I do that?
Oh, maybe I would.
But
maybe,
you know, there's no angle yet. But
right,
if I stumble across one,
it's possible.
I'll run it by you first.
Well, it's like they're thinking bigger. Because, like, I hate those people that you meet once or you have one encounter with. They're like, don't say anything on stage. I'm like, who the fuck are you?
You think you matter to me enough? The people who want you to talk about them on stage, you never end up talking about.
They're the worst.
Yeah. But it's been good for me just on that. On that front of dating comics occasionally of like, oh, this is what it feels like. Okay, maybe I should be aware of that with people in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. No, empathy is tricky, you know, in this game because, you know, so it's like, this is my life too. And these, you know, I own this. But it's I think there is sort of, in order to do the type of comedy that, you know, pushes the envelope a little bit, at least personally, there is a sort of lack of empathy. I wouldn't say it's sociopathic, but I do think it's selfish.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, once I break up with you, I'm going to say whatever I want. Like, if I'm in a relationship with you and you want to veto a bit, I may let you do that. Yeah. But if once we break up, you know, you've got to just trust that I'm a good enough person not to air something.
I'll tell the truth.
Right.
But even that's going to hurt a little bit.
Right.
Look at you.
Well, I was engaged last year, right? I mean, I do jokes about it in the special.
Yeah.
And we were like deciding, I was kind of deciding if I was going to stay with this person while preparing for this special.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was in my pettier moments, it's hard to know what is allowed to make jokes about. And I was like, I'm not going to do any jokes about him in the special. And then the new hour has more jokes about him. And our relationship. And again, you start off very like petty and, you know, sometimes you just go off on stage and people stop laughing and you go, okay, those were just feelings and I'm sorry about that.
But that's good though, because I don't think, I mean, because I do it the same way. I mean, you obviously generate on stage a lot.
Right. Yeah. But then once you hone it, then it becomes off a little classier.
Of course. But when the feelings are raw, they're raw. I mean, I did a whole show like about my ex-wife when she left me and it was horrible. And I shouldered most of the burden. But then I got, you know, I've done some pretty awful jokes in anger. And I don't like, I listen to some of that stuff on the CDs and I'm like, I don't regret it, but it wasn't professional.
Yeah,
because like there, even if you're like me and, you know, you sort of like, hey, man, it's hit or miss. I'm an acquired taste. I'm out here to entertain everybody, whatever. There is a line where I'm sort of like, that was just like raw as fuck.
Yeah.
And like, it's part of the process, but it shouldn't be the finished product.
Yes. Well, and with the internet now, everybody can look up who you're talking about. If you've posted with them,
I mean, you know,
my ex-fiance was not like a comedian or performer or anything, but like, if you Google my name and fiance, like, you could probably figure it out. Like,
yeah, everyone's got something, a little something out there.
Yeah, and so, you know,
a LinkedIn profile.
Right.
This poor guy.
Yeah, exactly. But if you date somebody who's a public figure, you know, you got to kind of be aware of that, I think.
Yes.
But that's a possibility.
Yeah, you know, it's all out there for everybody. They can get at us.
Yeah. It's so scary.
It's weird.
But that's why you share too much, you know, up front. So you go, I already told you that.
I do that naturally, but there have been moments where I'm like, but see, the thing is, nobody listens to everything you do. So no. if somebody comes at you with something, you're going to like, excuse me, if we could just go back 4 years ago to podcast number 804, it's pretty clear that I own that shit.
Yeah.
I can't believe everyone didn't know that I'm the opening monologue of that podcast, you know.
Right,
of
right.
The Robert Kelly episode. No one listened to that?
You're like, you're late, dude.
Well, that was always the assumption, too, before even talking about these new hours every year, is that there's this weird assumption that everybody has heard everything we've done. I mean, obviously, it's more possible with Netflix. Like, before, I would put out a CD, and I'm like, that's it for that hour. I'm like, no one bought that CD.
Right.
No one has listened to that CD. And you're throwing, I threw away, like, 5 hours of material.
Wow.
Only because, you know, like, because like, I already did it. And I don't feel bad about that, but the more I realize, I'm like, there's a lot of good shit there that no one will ever hear.
Right.
Ever.
Yeah.
There's like 4 or 5 CDs worth of shit that's like, it's out there and it was great, I think, but I can't do it again because I'm too proud or fucking, you know, I've got this idea.
But your fans can and will find it.
I wonder, like that album that, like the album that I did during the separation, Final Engagement, that's one of the, there was a trilogy. There was Not Sold Out, Still Tickets Available, and Final Engagement.
Right.
And Final Engagement is like dark, fucking brokenhearted, angry shit. And it's like 2 hours of it. And it's really, it's a rare, and every once in a while, someone will text me like, that's the one that really helped me. Louis Katz was going through a fucking breakup. He's like, I've been listening to that one. It's been
that's
really
amazing.
Helpful.
See, that's what I'm saying. People can find it.
Sure.
It's not like only
not
the people
forever.
Who bought that at the Funny Bone between 1990, whatever. Like, you know, you can go online and find all that and your fans do that.
Yeah.
And once people find you,
they might
want
to go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, of course. Everyone's binging now. When I find somebody I've never heard of and they have a lot of stuff that you can go through.
I'll do that with a musician sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah,
not
going to do it with everything.
Right. I mean, with comedians, we wouldn't do that. But
I just had that moment where just like sitting at that table after a half-filled gig with your CDs. And, yay.
And they're like, thanks.
Yeah. Wait, didn't like what? Where are you going?
Yeah. They just nod at you and pump the features hand. Like, you were great.
That's the fucking worst. Yeah, really liked your stuff. Hey,
cool.
Cool.
You're thanking them for coming. And they're like, you're welcome.
But why do we feel that? I mean, that hurts. That stings a little. But it's just part of the gig.
Yeah.
You know, that your feature's going to hand it to you maybe once a week.
Yeah, and you featured, so you remember people saying that to you.
Right, right.
And then you start headlining and you go, oh, that actually didn't mean anything when people said that to me because I was doing 20 minutes instead of an hour.
Right, right,
so
right.
Of course, you know, you remember them as being better.
Great,
It was a lifetime ago.
It's 18 minutes, man.
Yeah.
I was up there for an hour 10, hour 15. His 18 was good? Come on. Who can't do 18? You can do 18.
Well, it's the same thing as that woman complaining that she had heard things in your hour and a half. And you're like, I guess I should have done 50.
Yeah, you fucking fuck her. I went back and forth with her, too.
Really?
Well, she emailed me through the website. Oh, and I'm like, God. You fuck. And they hit. It's a nerve with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I didn't want to. I knew I went back too soon.
Yeah.
And so she got it. She struck the nerve, and I was like, yeah. I hate when they get you. Well, great job. I think we've covered it. Everybody's okay.
Yeah, I feel good about it.
Good, man. And we stayed at a distance. We're going to take a picture now
from a distance. Yeah. Yep. So we don't get any backlash.
Yeah, exactly. Because I'm posting pics of people that I've recorded weeks ago.
I saw that.
And people are like, what's going on?
Yeah.
It's a while ago. It was before everything
We thought you
changed.
Were woke, Mark.
Yeah. Nope. Nope. He's touching people. He's out there touching people. Good talking to you.
Thank you.
There you go, Taylor Tomlinson. I like her. Funny special. Go watch it. It's called Quarter Life Crisis. It's up there on the Netflix, and her boyfriend Sam do a thing. Sam Morrell, who'll be on the show Thursday. I think it's on YouTube. Is it on YouTube or Instagram? I think it's on YouTube. Hey, you'll find it. Maybe she mentioned it. I think she might have mentioned it. Anyway, look, and now I will play some music that's slightly reminiscent of Neil Young because... playing sort of the same guitar he is. And
Maybe some more chords, but then I change it. All right. Okay. Thank you.